We come now to oral questions. First, in the name of the Honourable Marama Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does he have confidence in the statements and actions of all his ministers?
Confidence in all of my ministers.
Does he agree with comments from the Auditor General on the Fast Track Approvals Bill that, quote, conflicts of interest, whether real or perceived, can create public concern around the integrity of decision making? And if so, has he sought any advice on how to manage conflicts of interest for ministerial decision makers?
That is why we'll manage conflicts of interest, and that's why we have an independent panel to make assessments around the economic and environmental impacts.
How many of the companies that Minister Bishop wrote to on 3rd April about the Fast Track Bill are the subject of conflicts of interest that any of his ministers have declared?
Well, the Minister did a great job reaching out to 280 organisations, many of them iwi-led organisations that actually want to participate in getting things built in this country. And what I'd just say to that member is we are going to get things built in this country, and we are very, very proud of that fast-track legislation.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. There wasn't any... Point of order.
Honourable Marama Davidson.
Thank you. There wasn't any addressing of the question at all. I can repeat it if the Prime Minister would prefer.
Well, the problem is, the first question was, does he have confidence in the statements and actions of his ministers? And he said, I have confidence in all my ministers. There really aren't too many more questions that can flow from that. So I'm letting it go, but I don't think it's reasonable to start pulling up the Prime Minister
guidance.
The question's actually been answered.
Point of order, speaking to the point of order, please, for genuine guidance, Mr Speaker, the exact question was how many of the companies that Minister Bishop...
No, I'm talking about your primary question. So once you've got an answer to the primary question, supplementary should relate to it. Where they don't, then I don't have much jurisdiction.
Thank you. On what date did he become aware...
Order, Mr Speaker. The primary question asked was actually a very broad question.
Yes.
It's absolutely legitimate then to probe into the actions, the statements and actions of ministers in the Prime Minister's government. And the only minister who can answer questions on conflict of interest is the Prime Minister. The supplementary question asked does directly relate to actions taken by ministers. It therefore flows logically from the primary question. It is absolutely within the Prime Minister's responsibility, and he hasn't even made any attempt to address it.
No,
this is a matter that is of significant interest to the overall integrity of government and democratic processes, and it's not unreasonable to expect the Prime Minister will make an attempt to answer it.
Bigger.
My
bigger.
Point...
No, bigger point of...
no, I'll call you in a moment.
Do I can.
There you go.
Mr Speaker.
Yes.
With respect, there is no company out there with a conflict of interest, and if there is, it requires the question...
When a point of order is being taken, nobody else speaks.
There is no company out there with a conflict of interest.
Does somebody over there has something to say. Well, you're getting your last say tomorrow, so we'll just leave it for now.
Point of order.
No, we've got a point of order.
There is, Mr. Speaker.
He did.
No company out there with a conflict of interest, and if there is, I call to that member, then please name them, other than have this innuendo and implied breach of parliamentary principles.
It's actually not a
by way of question time. That's my real point of order.
You're making a point. You're not making a point of order. Whoa, we're getting well out of control here. This hasn't happened to me before.
You get used to it. Mr. Speaker, but point of order, what was that point of order? Why was it not stopped? Or is it now legitimate for us to stand up, raise point of order and say whatever we like as part of a broader debate?
Well, with all due respect, an awful lot of people do that. But to be honest with you, I couldn't hear the first part of it because there was a lot of noise coming from down the back end of the house. So we'll just calm everything down. And I think the best way through this would be for Marama Davidson, the Honourable Marama Davidson, to ask her question again.
Yes. How many of the companies that Minister Bishop wrote to on 3rd April about the Fast Track Bill are the subject of conflicts of interest that any of his ministers have declared?
No projects have been selected yet for the fast track process. So the question is moot.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Mara Davidson.
Thank you. Is there a ruling that understands that the Prime Minister did not address my question for the New Zealand public?
I think it would be, appropriate to ask that question again and to just pick up a couple of words that are in the question. Way we go.
How many of the companies that Minister Bishop wrote to on 3rd April about the fast track bill are the subject of conflicts of interest that any of his ministers have declared?
Well, the member's not understanding where we are. The bottom line is that there have been no projects that have been selected yet, right? What we're saying very clearly is would you like the answer? We would like to we will make sure that there is conflicts of any interest are managed well, and we'll make sure that we've got an independent expert panel considering all things related to the project. But the member is well ahead of herself because there have been no projects selected at this stage.
To the company.
On what date did he become aware that at least one company in contact with his ministers about applying for fast track approval had donated to a coalition political party?
I'm not aware of that, but I know that we will manage conflicts of interest incredibly well with this process.
Did Minister Jones disclose donations of $50,000 to New Zealand First from entities with a connection to King's Quarry before Minister Bishop wrote to King's Quarry?
Point of order, the right honourable Mr. Peters.
Yeah, surely we are not going to have this process where someone so ignorant of our electoral law thinks they can come to this Parliament when disclosure is required to the Electoral Commission and to every other legal body and get away with that allegation.
Look,
no, Speaker, with the greatest respect, they don't know what they're doing here.
Well, sorry, just want to say this. A point of order needs to be a point of order. Can't be a point of political rebuttal. So that's the last of those we have today. Point of order, Chris Bishop.
Mr. Speaker, as the member, Marama Davidson, I think knows, the Prime Minister is not responsible for electoral law donations made by political parties.
From the right of Chris Hipkins.
The Prime Minister is absolutely responsible for conflicts of interest that flow from that. Where members are making decisions that relate to parties who have made donations to their campaigns, any conflict of interest that flows from that is absolutely the responsibility of the Prime Minister.
And I think the Prime Minister has answered by saying that those conflicts, where they occur, will be properly managed. I don't think he could say much more than that to the House. Honourable Marama Davidson, do you have another supplementary?
Mr Speaker, I hadn't got to the end of that question, so I will repeat that question it wasn't answered.
Actually, that's fair enough. You were interrupted.
Thank you. Did Minister Jones disclose donations of $50,000 to New Zealand First from entities with a connection to King's Quarry before Minister Bishop wrote to King's Quarry inviting them to apply for the fast track process?
I don't know how to be any more clear with the member, but there are no projects that have been approved under the fast track provisions at this stage. All that has happened is a form letter has gone out to a series of organisations making them aware of the process and the application process.
Point of order.
Supplementary question, the Honourable David Seymour.
Does receiving one of 280 letters saying that there will be a fast-track process to get more stuff finally built in New Zealand actually entitle anyone to any kind of consent to build anything?
No.
Oh, there we go.
Mr Speaker.
Honourable Marama Davidson.
If I can again point of order, please, on that previous question.
We can give it a go, but it better be a point of order.
Yes. Thank you, Mr Speaker. The question was, did Minister Jones disclose donations? And that was not at all addressed by the Prime Minister.
Well, I would assume that you know about the donation because it was disclosed. And so I don't think there's... So there's no point for me to rule on here.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Will he commit to providing an opportunity...
Hang on. Sure. Point of order, Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, there are two processes here that may be being confused. Ministers still have to declare political donations relevant to their responsibilities to the Cabinet Office under the conflict of interest process. That is a different process to the declaration through an electoral return declaration. And once again, the Prime Minister is responsible for that. And there are different timeframes associated with that. For example, donations that may not yet have been declared in electoral return still need to be declared to the Cabinet Office if a minister is making a decision about a related entity. So therefore, that question is both within order and also something the Prime Minister should be expected to answer.
Then ask the question again.
Thank you. Did Minister Jones disclose to Cabinet donations of $50,000 to New Zealand First from entities with a connection to King's Quarry before Minister Bishop wrote to King's Quarry inviting them to apply for the fast-track process?
Well, in response to the later part of that question, I'll answer that leg. I've said very clearly, no projects have been confirmed. All that has happened is a form letter has been sent out to a series of organisations, many of them iwi-led organisations, a range of corporates that actually want to participate in fast-track legislation. But the bigger point is very simple here. We are going to get things built in this country. And we are not apologising for that. We believe in fast-track legislation because we want modern, reliable infrastructure in this country so we can become more productive, we can give a higher standard of living.
Will he commit to providing an opportunity for public scrutiny of projects before the bill is set down for third reading to ensure transparency in light of the real risk of conflicts of interest?
Again, projects haven't been determined yet. We have a clear process that involves an expert panel that will weigh up the economic considerations, the environmental considerations, and ministers will make decisions. And won't that be great, because we'll finally get some stuff built in this country.
Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Does the Prime Minister agree with Chris Bishop?
Sure. It was on that side they were last, not us. That side got the last question.
Why is that? Your side got the last answer.
Does the Prime Minister agree with Chris Bishop that Shane Jones should have been sacked when he usurped an independent regulator to benefit a donor who is now the director of one of the companies invited to participate in the fast-track consenting process?
I'd say to that member as well, we have a fast-track process which we are incredibly proud about. We will manage any future perceived real conflicts of interest. Don't worry about that. We'll make sure we have a strong expert panel that can deliver the economic environmental considerations. We are going to get things done, unlike that member's last government who just talked and talked and didn't do a thing.
Somebody question. Supplementary question, right on, Winston Peters.
In the fast-tracking process, which is of such great interest today, has the Prime Minister and his Cabinet found it of use that there was a precedent of 19 fast-track projects under the former government?
Well, I think David Parker, potential future leader of the Labour Party, along with Phil Twyford as his deputy, actually put a good thing in place. And we've taken that and we've built on it and we're making it work.
Come to question number two in the name of Stuart Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Has she seen any recent reports on tax?
Mr. Speaker. Yes, I have seen a report from the OECD on fiscal drag and indexation of personal taxes. It explains how, in a progressive tax system, nominal wage growth leads to larger tax burdens. This includes wage growth that simply reflects inflation. If personal income tax thresholds are not adjusted over time, workers end up paying more and more of their income in tax.
Can the Minister give an example of fiscal drag in New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, the example I like to use in New Zealand is the median full-time wage and salary earner. In 2011, that person earned $48,000 a year and paid 15.5% of their income in tax. Today, they earn $73,400 and pay 20.6% of their income in tax. This is the consequence of not adjusting tax thresholds for 14 years. the average tax rate for someone who, by definition, is right in the middle of the income distribution has gone up by more than 5 percentage points. And, Mr Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition seems very concerned about the lack of adjustment to tax thresholds. Well, he had 6 years and he ignored working people and made no adjustment.
How do other countries deal with fiscal drag?
Well, Mr Speaker, more than half of OECD countries index their personal income tax thresholds. The report I referred to in my primary answer shows that of the 38 OECD countries, around 17 automatically adjust thresholds for inflation or some other index. Those countries include Canada, the United States, Denmark, France, Norway, and Sweden.
What do other OECD countries do about fiscal drag?
Mr Speaker, as I said, most OECD countries index tax thresholds. Of the rest, most have decided on a discretionary basis to adjust thresholds and/or rates over the last decade or so to provide tax relief, including Australia, the United Kingdom and Germany. Only a very small minority of OECD countries have decided not to provide personal income tax relief since 2010, and in fact have raised taxes. Those countries include Portugal, Greece and New Zealand.
Question number three, in the name of the Right Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does he stand by all of his government's statements and actions?
Yes, in particular, I stand by this government's action to ban mobile phones in schools. Officially kicking in yesterday, the ban is already helping young Kiwis focus on learning the skills they need to succeed, and schools across the country are reporting more engaged kids, louder playgrounds and sports fields at lunchtime, more positive interaction and less cyberbullying. We're committed to delivering better public services for Kiwis, and this is just one part of our plan to do exactly that.
Supplementary question. What additional factors was he made aware of between the 4th of March, when he expressed full confidence in Melissa Lee, and last week when he dismissed her from the broadcasting portfolio?
As I discussed last week, Melissa Lee and Penny Simmons, for that matter, are hard-working, good ministers doing an excellent job. But those portfolios became more complex and more complicated, and I want them managed by senior ministers.
Supplementary question. What additional factors was he made aware of between the 26th of March, when he expressed full confidence in Penny Simmons, and last week when he dismissed her from the disability portfolio?
Again, as I said, the agenda and disability issues became more complicated and complex, and I want that managed by more senior ministers. But what I'd just say is that that's the same leader who was his Prime Minister, along with Grant Robertson, who was former Minister of Finance, who actually got advice about the problems in that department agency and their management of their money and their budget, and did nothing about it. It was typical of his government not to face up to issues, not to deal with them. We're doing that.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
A point of order.
An answer, in reference to the last segment of the Prime Minister's answer, it neither related to the question nor is anything that the Prime Minister has any responsibility for. Will you give me a couple of extra supplementary questions in compensation for that?
Fair enough.
One. Thank you, Mr Speaker. Does he agree with David Seymour and Shane Jones' criticism of the Waitangi Tribunal? If not, why not?
Again, what I'd say to you, I have strong ministers doing an excellent job, and both those ministers are doing exactly that.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. I asked the Prime Minister whether he agreed with the criticism that David Seymour and Shane Jones have made of a government entity, the Waitangi Tribunal, and if he didn't, why he didn't agree with them. He didn't even address that.
Oh, I'll answer again.
Have another go. Yeah.
Look, I wouldn't characterise that way. What I would say is that I've made my statements on that, and you saw that in media last week.
Yep. Point of order, Mr Speaker. Public statements that ministers make, certainly the subject can be the subject of questioning, but they're not read into the record of the House. Any minister being asked a question shouldn't be referred simply to public statements that have been made. The minister has an obligation to answer to the House.
To address the question. The
obligation is, in fact, thank you, Mr Jones, I'll do this on my own, if that's all right, to address a question. And by saying that, he refers to public statements he's made as addressing the question.
Supplementary question. Does he believe that David Seymour and Shane Jones' criticism of the Waitangi Tribunal breaches the Cabinet Manual?
I wouldn't characterise it that way, and you've seen my statements on the issue.
Why does it not breach the Cabinet Manual?
Because I don't believe it does.
Supplementary question.
Can I...
The Right Honourable St. Peter's.
Can I ask the Prime Minister as to whether he's told his Cabinet colleagues...
Hang on a minute. Wait on. When questions are being asked, they're asked in silence. Right Honourable St. Peter's.
Has the Prime Minister told his Cabinet colleagues to concentrate on great principles and great political programs rather than venal, vicious personal attacks?
I think all my ministers are very clear. We are here to get things done for New Zealanders, and they're doing a great job doing that.
Supplementary question. Will the Prime Minister take disciplinary action against ministerial colleagues like David Seymour and Shane Jones attacking the legitimacy of the Waitangi Tribunal in breach of the Cabinet Manual? If not, why not?
Look, I have to say the sanctimony from that member is quite outrageous, because it took him longer to sack Michael Wood than it will take for the backbench to sack him.
Speaker, not only does the Prime Minister not have responsibility for that, he hasn't addressed the question that was asked.
That was the problem.
Well, he did by saying that he didn't agree with the sanctimony of the question, which is a kind of a dismissing, but it's nonetheless addressing the question.
Supplementary question. Who is right, the Prime Minister, who said that ultimately he determines the performance of Cabinet Ministers, or David Seymour, who said that the Prime Minister sacking an ACT Minister would be a breach of the faith of the Coalition Agreement and would be a major problem?
The Prime Minister.
Oh, very good. That's
useful. Question. Question number four, the name of Debbie Naruwapeka.
Tēnā koe, Tapika. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by all his government's policies and actions?
Yes.
Now, can I just make a point?
Oh.
I'm not going to stop the questions, but when you ask a question like that, stand by all his government's policies and actions, he says yes. How many more questions can there be? So I think we just need to all think a little bit about question time and its purpose. But Debbie Nauru will pack it, huh?
Thank you. What opportunity will the public be given to weigh in on projects that will be approved in their community as a result of the Fast Track Approvals Bill?
Great fast track process. It's designed to get things built in this country. But a key component of it is an independent expert panel that will weigh up considerations both economically, environmentally, and socially, and inform ministers.
Supplementary. How can the public have confidence in this government's cabinet overseeing the decisions of the 100 projects in the Fast Track Approvals Bill when ministers are not disclosing their conflicts of interest?
Oh, here we go.
Well, there are no projects that have been approved.
Supplementary. What actions will the Prime Minister take to ensure that his cabinet ministers will adhere to the cabinet manual around the conflict of interests, if given, for the Fast Track Approvals Bill?
We have well-established processes on managing perceived or real conflicts of interest. But again, we make no apologies about introducing Fast Track legislation. It is important that we get things done in this country. We are over the talk and discussion. We need to get things built.
Supplementary. Has the Prime Minister got any register of current conflicts of interest before the beginning of the Fast Track Approvals Bill, as it hits the Select Committee, or after the Select Committee process?
Again, what we have well-established processes for managing ministerial conflicts of interest, the Cabinet Office and ministers, but again, we have not yet got a full set of projects. We haven't got any projects approved yet. That's the point of introducing this legislation, so we can get some projects approved and done and building.
Somebody question, Mr. Speaker. Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Mr. Speaker, sorry, point of order. Mr. Speaker, that questioner said that ministers are not disclosing conflicts of interest. Now, sir, that is a very serious allegation.
Yeah.
There's not one shred of evidence to back it up, no proof whatsoever, just an insinuation of deceit by parliamentarians in this House. That, sir, is not acceptable into standing orders. It's going to lead to serious disorder and a few home troops if she goes any further down that track.
Standing orders refer to dishonourable allegations made against members. I can't remember the number. Debbie Norrie Packer, did you want a point of order?
Point of order.
Point of order.
At no time did I make any allegation. I was seeking clarity of process, but I do seek guidance on your ruling and I'm quite happy for Hansard to be checked. I think Te Pāti Māori needs to deserve to clear their name if we've been alleged of making some gross untruth.
Good. Well, I'll have a look at Hansard and come back to you. Do you have another
supplementary? What is the response to the Waitangi Tribunal's urgent on his government's plan to repeal 7AA from the Oranga Tamariki Act released yesterday, which stated it would cause actual harm to vulnerable children?
Our government is going to make sure that the well-being of children comes first, but that issue is before the courts and it's inappropriate for me to comment.
Supplementary. Does he agree with Tama Pōtaka on July 26, 2023, regarding the repeal of Section AA that, quote, it would be contradictory of us to dismiss the provision entirely, which is intended to be a genuine option to address and meet the best interests of the child in state care, unquote.
Again, this government is focusing on making sure the well-being of a child comes first and foremost is the important thing that we have to do. But this matter is before the courts and I won't be commenting any further on it.
A supplementary. Does he agree with Hareti Hipango in July 23 regarding Section 7A that, quote, if the National Party gets into government, we would not be repealing it? And if so, what has changed since then?
We are going to make sure that we prioritise the welfare of our most vulnerable children so they end up in loving homes. That is job number one. But I will not be making any further comments given that this is under appeal through the courts this week.
That's right. Court case.
Question number five, in the name of Katie Nimmin.
My question is to the Ministry of Education and asks what report has she seen about the away for the day cell phone policy?
Good question.
The
Mr.
Honourable
Speaker,
Erica Sandin.
There have been overwhelmingly positive responses to our often away all day policy to ban the use of cell phones in school. The Secondary Principals Association said that schools who started the year with the ban are reporting less distraction and more interaction in the playground, with a lot of children out playing sport or heading to the library. I am proud of this government that we're prepared to take decisive action, and that's why from the first day of Term 2, all schools were required to implement the cell phone use ban to ensure every student has the same opportunity to succeed at school.
Supplementary. What evidence has she seen to support New Zealand's cell phone policy?
Mr. Speaker, a recent study published by the Norwegian Institute of Public Health wrote that banning smartphones significantly reduced bullying, improved the grades of students and significantly decreased the number of visits students made to see mental health specialists. The study also found that schools that implemented a policy removing phones for the whole day, not just class time, experienced a larger increase in student educational performance. That is why it is our expectation that cell phones are off and away all day so we can get back to basics and ensure our kids are literate, numerate and aspirational about their futures.
Supplementary. What feedback has she seen from school principals about the away for the day cell phone policy?
Mr. Speaker, principals from across the country continue to write to me to tell me how wonderful it is to hear the noise in the playground with more students talking to each other, playing games and connecting. One Dunedin secondary school principal reported that restricting pupils' cell phones resulted in a massive drop in harmful social media incidents. The Hornby High School principal said he wished they'd done it 5 years ago. He said, we're seeing kids outside playing games, throwing balls, reading books and generally interacting more positively rather than having heads down on a phone. This policy is part of our wider plan to lift student achievement and wellbeing.
Supplementary. What feedback has she received while recently abroad about the cell phone policy?
Mr. Speaker, last week in Singapore I had the opportunity to meet with many of my international counterparts. The number one thing I was asked about were cell phones. Ministers of Education from around the world asked me to share our approach and why it had been so successful. Other countries are also making changes. The UK government has also taken steps to prohibit cell phones in their schools. The UK Secretary for Education explained that by prohibiting mobile phones, schools can create safe and calm environments free from distraction so all pupils can receive the education they deserve. Mr Speaker, this government is committed to getting the basics right, supporting Kiwi kids to succeed. Getting cell phones out of schools was just the start, and there's a lot more to come.
Question number six, in the name of the Honourable Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does she stand by her statement, quote, "We will both be sustaining frontline services and, in the cases of the areas I outlined in my opening remarks, increasing funding for those services," unquote?
Mr Speaker, yes. I stand by my full statement in the context in which it was given. In my opening remarks to the Finance and Expenditure Committee about the budget policy statement, I said, quote, "Frontline services like health, education and law and order will get more funding." And I'm proud to say that in Budget 2024, they certainly will.
Supplementary. What directions did she give to ministers or chief executives in avoiding cuts to frontline services?
Mr Speaker, I said that when agencies were putting forward savings proposals, they should apply good judgment and be careful that proposals should not put frontline services at risk.
Supplementary. Is it good judgment for DIA to make cuts to the child exploitation team, cuts to carer support funded through Whaikaha, and Customs cutting its border services?
Mr Speaker, and what has become a habit from that member? She tends to paraphrase and summarise a series of loosely connected facts and make assertions about them. In the case of what I think are restructuring proposals that the member is in this question referring to, I would note that they are under consultation and therefore no final decisions have been taken.
Supplementary. Does she believe she can commit to her commitment of no frontline service cuts when she is doing nothing to enforce her expectations as part of Budget 2024?
Oh, Mr Speaker, I'll tell you how we roll over here. We enforce our expectations.
Supplementary. Has Cabinet signed...
Just wait for your own colleagues.
Supplementary. Has Cabinet signed off this year's budget? And if so, on what date was it agreed to?
Mr Speaker, Cabinet processes are not something I think it's in the public interest to divulge at this time, but I am pleased that the member opposite is obviously as excited as I am about the 2024 budget. You'll have to wait till the 30th of May when I deliver it, and I'm sorry, you're not going to get first dibs on the content.
Supplementary. Is the reason she is so committed to delivering her tax cuts as part of Budget 2023 is because protecting her own job is more important than the jobs of frontline workers?
Well, Mr Speaker, why it's important to me to provide tax relief to working people is that, unlike the members opposite, I don't think it's the man in high-vis or the woman in the nurse's uniform that should always be the last to get relief. And unlike the members opposite, I'm not going to continue on a path of low-value spending, of wasteful programs like merging TVNZ and RNZ and Three Waters reform, when there are working people paying more and more of their income in tax who've had to endure a cost-of-living crisis, her party fuelled. We are delivering them tax relief. They've worked hard and they earn it.
Question number seven, the name of Chloe Swilbrick.
To the Prime Minister, does he stand by his government's statements and actions?
Yes, and especially this government's action to bring back three strikes. Communities across New Zealand are sick and tired of seeing what happens when a government spends years embedding a soft-on-crime approach that prioritise offenders over victims, and that's why we're making the changes, because New Zealanders expect this government to restore law and order.
What is the cost of a two-zone fare for on the bus for a teenager in Auckland today, and what will it be tomorrow when the government cancels half-price public transport fares?
If you'd like to put that in a specific question, I'm sure we can get an answer for you.
Supplementary. How, Mr Speaker?
Yeah, regardless of what people think of the question, we'll hear it in silence.
To the Prime Minister. How exactly does doubling the cost of public transport for teenagers help families with the cost of living?
Well, there'll still be support for those that are on community services cards and mobility services. There are obviously student discount rates. But what's important, and what this government's working incredibly hard to do, is make sure that we support low and middle income working New Zealanders by giving them tax relief. It's been 14 long years. It's been a 40% increase in the cost of goods through inflation. They deserve tax relief. They work incredibly hard. We're going to deliver it to them, and that will help them navigate the cost of living crisis.
What is Trade Me's national median rent price today, and what was it when his government was elected last year?
Again, if you'd like to put that as a specific question, I'm sure we can get you an answer.
When, if ever, will the $2.9 billion landlord tax cut trickle down to the 1.5 million renters in this country?
Well, as I've said to this member before, we have a problem with housing in this country, and it has not been solved by the previous administration over the last 6 years, but we are determined to work hard at solving it. And the problem is a supply challenge. It's a supply challenge. You can't buy a house, you can't afford one. Supply challenge on the rental market, supply challenge in the state housing market. And we are working incredibly hard to make sure we get the settings right to put downward pressure on rents, because we're not having $170 per week increase in average rents. We are working hard to make sure we put downward pressure.
Will the Prime Minister then commit to rent prices coming down under his government, or is that all hot air?
We're putting downward pressure on rents, and we're doing that by restoring interest deductibility, a legitimate business expense. We're making sure we bring back the bright line test, and we're balancing the laws between tenants and landlords.
Question number 8, in the name of the Honourable Dr. Aisha Birrell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. Does he stand by a statement that we stand by our commitments, that we won't be reducing the front line, that we will continue to deliver services as effectively as we can, and that the cuts we're talking about are mostly back office cuts?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, yes, I stand by my statement. This government is absolutely committed to delivering services as effectively as we can to ensure that New Zealanders can access the healthcare they deserve.
Supplementary, how can it be true that frontline services aren't being reduced when hospitals are under instruction from Health New Zealand leadership to reduce the use of casual nurses who cover roster gaps across a range of services?
Mr. Speaker, this is a reflection that in the calendar year 2023, I'm informed that 2,500 nurses entered the workforce.
Thank you,
and
Labor.
As a consequence of that, we are needing to acquire less penal time and less overtime.
Supplementary, why are doctors being told they cannot fill vacant specialist roles in hospitals, even when they have identified appropriately qualified doctors in what is still a globally tight market for specialists?
Mr. Speaker, it is a globally tight market for specialists, and I'm informed that 200 full-time equivalent specialists joined the health workforce in calendar year 2023. Having said that, I'm reassured by Health New Zealand that health services are safe and they are simply looking for efficiencies, such as the $2.75 million they found in one hospital in the past 3 months for more efficient procurement of consumables.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. My question was about...
Yeah, OK, I'll call you for a point of order.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Dr. The Honourable Aisha Birrell.
Mr. Speaker, my question was a very practical question about why doctors couldn't appoint to roles, and that was not addressed in the question.
Well, ask the question again.
Why are doctors being told that they cannot fill vacant specialist roles in hospitals, even when they have identified appropriately qualified doctors in what is still a globally tight market for specialists?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, I'm informed by Health New Zealand that 200 full-time equivalent specialists were into the health system in calendar year 2023, and sometimes this is simply a matter of timing. We look forward to employing more SMOs as we're able to.
Supplementary, why did he deny in a statement to Radio New Zealand that there is a hiring freeze in public hospitals when Health New Zealand wrote to hospitals on the to health unions on the 17th of April to say that all unfilled roles were being reviewed and considered for removal?
Mr. Speaker, people are currently being hired today.
Can he understand why health workers are angry that after he campaigned on a workforce crisis, the minister is now blocking hospitals from filling gaps through a hiring freeze in public hospitals?
Mr. Speaker, what I do understand is that during the campaign, I said that health workforce was a number one priority. That member did not.
Appointments. Supplementary, why won't he admit that 6 months in, his government has already broken its promise not to cut frontline health jobs, and it's taking the country backwards.
Mr Speaker, I won't take advice on broken promises from a member who said that non-orthopaedic wait lists more than 365 days would be met by the end of last year, which was a terrible failure.
Question number 9, in the name of Paulo Garcia.
My question is to the Minister for Disability Issues. What recent announcements, if any, has the Minister made?
Okay.
Oh, Honourable Louise Hutch.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. This morning I announced an independent review of disability support services. Our government is committed to improving the lives of disabled New Zealanders. This review aims to ensure that support services enhance the lives of disabled people in the long term. We've already committed additional funding this financial year to ensure disabled people get the services they need.
Supplementary. Why is the independent review of disability support services needed?
Mr Speaker, substantial challenges have been encountered delivering support services. Despite the hard work of many, the current track is unsustainable. Something has to be done. The review aims to ensure that support services enhance the lives of disabled people and gives them certainty about access to support. Whaikaha, the Ministry of Disabled People, welcomes this review and I look forward to working with them.
Supplementary. How long will the review take?
Mr Speaker, I should review recommendations within 4 months. Once the review is complete, I will consult the disability community seeking their feedback. I'm committed to listening to the views of disabled people, their families and their carers before making changes.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question. The Honourable... Priyanka Radhakrishna.
Thank you, Mr Speaker.
Priyanka, sorry, apologies.
Can I go now?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Mr Speaker, to the Minister for Disability Issues. Will this review, which was already announced on the 26th of March this year, include the option of reversing the changes to disability support funding that were announced and implemented on 18th March?
Mr Speaker, the terms of reference of the review are now public. We want to ensure that we understand the issues that were created when the Ministry was set up, to understand the issues they face today. But more importantly, Mr Speaker, what we need to do to fix these challenges so that disabled New Zealanders get access to the support they need.
Supplementary.
Paulo Garcia.
Is this the first time in recent years disability support services have been reviewed?
No. The Ministry was created to improve disability support services and it was established quickly, which meant long-standing challenges weren't addressed. The latest government's implementation unit, you might want to listen to this, the last government's implementation unit raised red flags in 2023 about the viability of disability support services. Clearly, challenges were always known, and the last government did not address them. Our government will confront these challenges so disabled people are assured that there is ongoing support for years to come.
Well done.
Question number 10, the name of Todd Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Health, Farmac, and asks, what recent announcements about improving Kiwis' access to medicines?
Now you can start again.
Oh, I'll go again. Great. Our Minister, what recent announcements...
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Questions are going to be heard in silence.
My question. What recent announcements has he made about improving Kiwis' access to medicines?
Mr Speaker.
David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I'd like to acknowledge the presence of the Right Honourable John Key, who's clearly at a loose end. In respect of pharmaceuticals and medicines for New Zealanders, I announced yesterday that we will have a budget of nearly $1.6 billion a year for medicines for Kiwis for the next 4 years. Mr. Speaker, for many New Zealanders, funding medicine means life or death, or the difference between a life of pain and suffering or living freely. This government has managed to make the sacrifices in other areas by cutting waste to fund these vital medicines so they don't get cut.
Supplementary. Why was there a need to announce this package?
Mr. Speaker, the previous government talked a big game about care and kindness, but when it came to funding medicines, they budgeted 1.4...
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Just start the answer again without the political attack. I'm sure the member's capable of doing that.
Mr. Speaker, I make only the most factual statements, and I was trying to compliment them. But nevertheless, in spite of the rhetoric surrounding medicines, the previous government forecasted for 4 years $1.5 billion this year and only $1.1 billion for the coming 3 years. That meant when this government came into office, Pharmac, who buy medicines for New Zealanders, said, if you don't do something about this, we will spend the next year not funding new medicines, but deciding which patients to exclude from existing medicines and which medicines to take off the list. As a result, this government has had to find another $455 million a year, or $1.774 billion in total, to fill in that fiscal cliff where the previous government had not put the money aside to fund the medicines people need. In doing this, Mr. Speaker, we face three options. We could tax, overtax households and businesses more. We could borrow another $1.774 billion, or we could find savings of waste in other areas to pay for the medicines people need. We've done the third one, and that sums up how this government is taking on this budget.
Supplementary.
Good. Just make sure the answers are a bit more concise. Do you have a supplementary? Supplementary, the Honourable Nicola Willis.
Does the minister think it is a prudent way to manage New Zealand's fiscal situation, to leave critical medicines unfunded in the budget, such as the last government did in budget 2023, so that those medicines would have to be delisted if it weren't from the prudent decision of this government to fund them?
Mr. Speaker, I have no responsibility for being...
Point of order, Honourable Kerry McNulty.
Mr. Speaker, given the ruling that you've just given in this series of questions, the House needs, I believe, needs to understand how that question was allowed that gave reference specifically to the previous government in the question. This is a dance that we have to have every single question time, it seems, that the government ministers are repeatedly ignoring your instructions.
Speaking to the point of order, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, how is it possible that we as a government find ourselves with a $1.8 billion hole of negligence left by those guys and we're not allowed to talk about it in question time?
And my point in response to Honourable Kerry McNulty is that there is a difference between an outright attack and a reference to actions of a previous government. And actions of a previous government are not ruled out and have not been ruled out. The reference to the budget of a previous government, therefore, is in order.
Mr. Speaker, far be it from me to be the Minister of Finance's thesaurus, but I would say that setting up expectations amongst New Zealanders of something as vital as medicine and not actually putting aside the money to pay for it is not only imprudent, it is frankly dishonest and misleading to the New Zealand public. And I'm proud to say that this government has funded each and every year adequate money for the medicines Kiwis need.
Don't make me stand up.
Supplementary?
Well, it might be the last one, but Todd Stevenson.
Thank you. How will this announcement help to support New Zealanders' healthcare?
Mr. Speaker, we are at the moment in a time of extraordinary technical revolution when it comes to medicines. The question is whether New Zealanders can keep up with the first world expectations that they have for themselves and their families. This funding means that many medicines that would have been at risk of delisting will continue. That includes 30 new medicines funded since 2022, 31 with widened access to more patients, and decisions that have been recently made or are in progress, such as funding continuous glucose monitors, insulin pumps and myeloma treatments. Those would have been at risk under the budget this government we inherited. They are now viable because we've found the savings of waste elsewhere to put the money into medicines Kiwis need.
Supplementary, the Honourable Nicola Willis.
Has the Minister seen comments by a member of this House who referred to his decision to rescue Pharmac through this funding boost as, quote, fiscal jiggery pokery? And does he think the Honourable Dr. Ayesha Verrill was wrong to suggest that funding medicine is anything but good policy?
No, that's not a question for answer. No, it's not a question. I haven't called you. You need to sit down. Yep. I call the Honourable Willow Jean Prime.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Children. Does she stand by all her statements and actions?
The Honourable Karen Choi.
Yes.
Does she stand by her statement that there will be no frontline cuts to services providing care and protection to children?
Yes.
Can she assure the House that the International Child Protection Unit that focuses on cross-border issues like child labour exploitation, sexual exploitation and child trafficking will not be disestablished? And if not, why not?
I don't have ministerial responsibility for some of those.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Willow Jean Prime.
I am referring to the International Child Protection Unit within Oranga Tamariki. She does have ministerial responsibility for Oranga Tamariki.
Minister might like to... Minister might like to elaborate on the answer.
There is a restructure going on right now, and there is a proposal that has been put before Oranga Tamariki. No final decisions have been made, and consultation is happening at the moment.
Supplementary. Why does the Minister endorse disestablishing the unit that plays a crucial role in preventing and addressing child labour exploitation, child sexual exploitation and child trafficking and smuggling?
It's a bit hard to say that the Minister's taken a position when the Minister's just actually said that the matter is under review.
Why is the Minister then proposing to disestablish the unit that plays a crucial role in preventing and addressing child labour exploitation, child sexual exploitation and child trafficking and smuggling?
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you have another way of asking the question that you want without the accusation at the start of the question?
Does the Minister support the Ministry's proposal to disestablish the unit that plays a crucial role in preventing and addressing child labour exploitation, child sexual exploitation and child trafficking and smuggling?
Oranga Tamariki is currently going through a restructure. All this is still under proposal and consultation is still happening. Oranga Tamariki has my expectation that the best interests of our young people are at the forefront of all their decision making, and that is my expectation.
Point of order.
Point of order.
The Minister didn't answer my question. My question was, does she support it?
No, the Minister did answer your question. The Minister said that the matters were under review, and then she stated what her expectation was
from that review. I don't think you can get better than that.
As the Minister for Children, why is the Minister standing by cuts to agencies and services that are dedicated to the protection of children?
Oranga Tamariki needs to get back to its core focus, which is care and protection of our young people. That we are streamlining the organisation to focus on the care and protection of our young people. We need to get back to the basics and do it better than we have been.
Supplementary, the Honourable Nicola Willis.
Does the Minister agree with the statement by the Chief Executive of Oranga Tamariki in relation to the restructuring proposal that it was developed with the care and protection of children at its centre, with reductions and changes focused on reducing and streamlining the back office, keeping the roles of the front line out of the scope for change so as not to affect the services we provide on the ground to Tamariki, Rangatahi and whānau?
Absolutely. Stakeholder groups, opposition parties, governments, iwi and hapu have all been asked for real change in Oranga Tamariki. This is what real change looks like.
No, you've run out of them, even with the extras that were offered earlier. So we'll move now to question number 12, Cameron Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Commerce and Consumer Affairs and asks, what recent announcements has he made regarding regulations in the Credit Contracts and Consumer Finance Act 2003?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Andrew Bailey.
The Coalition Government recently announced two important but related announcements relating to the Triple CFA, which has plagued personal and mortgage lending over recent years. Firstly, we are removing 11 pages of overly prescriptive affordability regulations to consumer and mortgage lending so people can more easily borrow money when and if they need it. And secondly, we're streamlining and enhancing dispute resolution services so Kiwis are properly protected if they are subject to poor lending practices.
Supplementary. Why were these reforms a priority for the Coalition Government?
Mr. Speaker. First of all, these changes were part of the National Act Coalition Agreement, but secondly, they were a priority because the regulations introduced by the previous government were so bad that they harmed the very people they were meant to protect. This coalition government is committed to cutting red tape, and these regulations were a handbrake and did more harm than good.
Supplementary. How will removing 11 pages of regulations from the Triple CFA help people get a mortgage or personal loan?
Mr. Speaker, by removing these regulations, it will bring back more balance to the need to properly assess affordability with the need for Kiwis to access finance when they need it. At the moment, many reputable lenders simply do not offer small personal loans because of their overbearing compliance costs. And it is families who have worked hard to buy a house who can't actually get a mortgage because they have to jump through unnecessary hoops.
Supplementary. Does the Minister have any further plans regarding the Triple CFA?
Mr. Speaker, in the coming weeks we will begin consulting on the legislative changes to the Triple CFA reforms. But I'll just say this is just the beginning of reforms that will help improve Kiwis' access to finance, cut red tape and help rebuild the economy.
Well done. Great work. That concludes oral questions.